Partington.
Good morning. My name is Earl Partington. I'm the appellant in this case. I'm asking leave of the court to appear at this argument because my attorney is stuck in a political corruption trial in Boston.
I understood that, but your brief was also signed by a Virginia attorney.
Yes, Mr. Giddens he is out of town and has never been anticipated that he would be here. I only found out on Monday, and I flew in last night, and I'm flying back after lunch today. This case, I think, presents some very important issues, and I submit that behind those issues, sort of hovering there, is the Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
That's not before us.
Excuse me,
Your Honor? That's not before us.
No, Your Honor, but I...
The Sixth Amendment right to counsel belonged to the represented.
That's correct, but
this case is about the attorney.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I'm saying that this is something that is in the background. The real question here, I think, before this court immediately at the state of this case is there statutory authority for what the Navy is claiming? That is the right to discipline civilian attorneys. We're not dealing here with a court disciplining civilian attorneys. We're not dealing with an administrative body such as the NLRB trying to discipline attorneys. We're dealing here with the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, who is the chief prosecutor for the United States in Navy and Marine criminal cases, claiming that authority.
When you become authorized, licensed, admitted to the military courts, do you not submit to the rules of the court?
You don't get licensed to appear at courts martial, Your Honor.
I tried to use about three different verbs there to figure out. When you become authorized to appear in those military courts, what is the process then?
As long as you are a member in good standing of any bar of the highest court of any state or territory in the United States or any federal court, then you are authorized to appear in a courts martial.
Okay.
So is it your point that Rule 109 had no authority to issue Rule 109?
No, I think Rule 109 is correct. Oh. The government relies on this phrase, other attorneys.
Yes. Of course they do.
But as an Army officer myself.
Then I don't understand your argument because it says that they can impose rules on judge advocates and other lawyers. Isn't that you?
No, I submit that other lawyers refers.
You're not another lawyer?
Well, yes, but it refers to other lawyers in the military.
Where does it say that?
It doesn't, but I'm saying that there is no basis.
Well, do you have any authority for that? I mean, I'm just looking at the plain language of it. It says judge advocates and other lawyers.
Who practice in proceedings governed by the code and this manual, which is, that's this.
Well, except you have to be careful.
It
originally
perfectly describe you.
Well, I submit that in the context of the rule, it is not describing civilian attorneys. It is describing non-JAG attorneys in the military. And let me explain why. The government, when they originally took the action they did, relied on Article 6 and 27 of the Code, clearly inapplicable. When the matter got to the district court, the government relied generally on the Constitution. When the district court ruled that Article 36...
You're not explaining the question that we just asked.
I'm trying to, Your Honor. I'm really trying to.
Does this somehow lead to the point of why other attorneys doesn't include
Yes,
the
Your Honor.
Attorneys?
The district court ruled that Article 36 applied, that authorized the rules that could cover civilian attorneys. But Article 36 is limited to proceedings under the code and to persons subject to the code. Attorney disciplinary proceedings are not proceedings under the code, nor are civilian attorneys persons subject to the code. So Rule 109, to the extent that other attorneys is interpreted as civilian attorneys, would be beyond the scope of the president to prescribe in the manual for courts martial. And I'd point out there is nothing in anywhere in the legislative history of the Uniform Code of Military Justice or any of its amendments where this issue has ever been discussed or suggested. And as pointed out in the brief, when Congress wishes to give this authority to an executive official, they do it by an express statute, and in that statute they designate who is the official ultimately responsible for the discipline. I've given you the examples of the Patent Office and the Internal Revenue Service. There is nothing here to indicate that this is what Congress intended.
Okay. Why not just read it that Congress intended anyone who practices in the proceedings is subject to discipline?
Well, they are, but the question is it discipline by the Navy or some other body? The logical place, if discipline was to be placed for
discipline
people...
By the JAG.
Well, the logical place for it would be the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, a civilian court, not in the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, who is the chief prosecutor.
Court of very limited jurisdiction, the CAF is.
Well, that's correct.
Most practice before the courts martial does not involve the CAF in any direct fashion, or the COMA, as it used to be called. I think they deliberately got rid of that acronym.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor, but I'm suggesting that if the Navy is going to claim this jurisdiction, that's where it should be vested. And it should not be vested in the Judge Advocate General when there is no legislative history relating to this whatsoever. There is no indication that this was ever contemplated when the Uniform Code was enacted. This is just a regulation promulgated by the Judge Advocate General of the Navy. And to them, they say, well, Article 36 authorizes the President to enact Rule 109. Well, I agree, but I would have thought that if the rule is going to apply to civilian attorneys, it would have made it very clear to other military and civilian attorneys.
It seems pretty clear to say judge advocates and other lawyers. I don't understand how the other version is any clearer.
Well, I'm really submitting there is no...
I would like it better right
no,
now.
No, there's no statutory authority for the enactment of Rule 109 to apply to civilian attorneys, and it raises serious issues of military control over civilians.
You may want to move on to your next point. If you assume you lose on this point, then you come to whether you're entitled to due process.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but I would like to make one point on this.
Your time's limited.
I know. Our founding fathers were very concerned about the role of the military having authority over civilians, and I think this case typifies the problems. The military just assuming they can make this claim without any statutory authority. I will move on to the other issues. The government has conceded that I'm entitled to judicial review under the Administrative Procedure Act. The question
just on your separation of powers point, but isn't the discipline here only for future military proceedings?
Well, except that they sent it out to all the bars I belong to, and I've been disciplined by two of them, three of them. All the others have stayed matters. It's one thing if this just involved what the Navy and Marine Corps did, but they deliberately sent it to my bar so that I got a cascading effect of being disciplined without ever having had...
They're not making decisions. I understand the effects of that, and I get that. But the decision they themselves are making is limited to the military system.
Well, that would be the only authority they could have anyway.
Exactly. So regardless. Your point about military control over civilians, they weren't going outside who can practice in the military proceedings.
Well, that's correct. But the civilian attorney is the bulwark against unlawful command influence in the military. Mm-hmm. And this is really a serious question. It is very common for military lawyers to be unwilling to raise issues that might jeopardize their career. It is left to the civilian lawyer to do this.
Okay. Well, interrupted you on your due process.
Okay, most defendants in courts martial don't have civilian lawyers.
No, because they have to pay for them.
Right. By the way, we have not seen that in our Guantanamo cases at all, what you just said.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
I said we have not seen any evidence of what you just said in our Guantanamo cases that we've been hearing for years.
Well,
we've seen unbelievably independent JAG lawyers raising very important issues that obviously troubles their command. I mean, I have to tell you, I just don't see any evidence of this here, and we've been hearing these cases for 5 years.
At the Maury case, as a classic example, Lieutenant Colonel Maury had to sue in order to get a fair hearing for a promotion. And I might add, the literature since the enactment of the code is filled with the discussion of this problem. This is a very common problem that has been discussed over and over again in the literature. And there's in congressional hearings, there has been a lot of discussion about this particular issue. So I submit, Your Honor, there is significant evidence out there about this problem. But if I may return to the due process, because I'm running quickly out of time, certainly any attorney in any disciplinary proceeding is entitled to due process. And the real question is...
Yeah, assume that you went on that, but you still then face the question of did you get the due process?
Oh, yes.
So we can decide this case on a different basis than the district court did.
Yes.
Even though this maybe starts under APA type review, it comes to us from the district court.
But I submit that the judicial review should be in the district court, not in this court. This court should review the district court's judicial review. Part of the problem we have here is the Navy went after me for two statements that were made in the argument portion of the brief. One of which, I used the past perfect tense in the verb, the Navy changed the tense to the past and found me guilty of saying something I never said. And in the other, all the other allegations related to my argument that the military judge entered findings and not guilty, which is indisputably true. He did. And after he entered them, he turned to the military prosecutor and said, "Do you understand what I just did?" And the military has charged me with making a false statement when the statement is indisputably true. And this is of great concern because this shows bad faith on the part of the military. This shows this is an attack upon civilian counsel. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, what little there is, unless the court has more questions.
Do you have further questions?
No.
Thank you, counsel. You can reserve. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you.
Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. At the core of this case, there are three main issues. The first is whether or not the Judge Advocate General for the Navy is statutorily authorized to discipline civilian attorneys appearing in Navy JAG proceedings. The second was whether or not the appellant received all the process that he was due. And the third is whether or not the Navy decision to suspend the appellant for conduct occurring in the court-martial proceedings comported with the Administrative Procedure Act. Mr. Partington has conceded that 10 U.S.C. 836, which authorized the president to prescribe rules for court-martial proceedings, in fact authorized the promulgation of Rule 109A. And as this court has noted, Rule 109A refers to not only military judge advocates, but to other lawyers. There is nothing in that rule, and Mr. Partington was unable to point to anything, that indicates that the term other lawyers should be limited to only military lawyers. And in fact, that does not make sense because the Navy JAG is responsible for the supervision and discipline of lawyers that are who are appearing in court-martial proceedings. And since civilian lawyers appear in court-martial proceedings and the Navy JAG is responsible for their conduct, the Navy JAG must be authorized to discipline when misconduct occurs in those court-martial proceedings. Therefore, it is clear that there was a statutory basis for the promulgation of the rule that covers civilian attorneys. The second issue, if the court has no questions on that, is whether or not Mr. Partington received all the process to which he was entitled. I think the record is replete with evidence that he was given time and time again an opportunity to review the charges and to submit materials. He was given the court's opinion, which is what the written complaint that started this proceeding, and that opinion by the court listed four specific misrepresentations that troubled the court. He was given that. He was then offered an opportunity to respond when the initial inquiry was done by Captain Przenski. He was told what the standard of proof was for Captain Przenski's investigation. He was given an opportunity to submit materials. After that initial inquiry was done and it moved on to an ethics investigation, he was given a copy of Captain Przenski's very detailed findings of fact and conclusions with respect to the misrepresentations made. He was given multiple opportunities during the ethics investigation to submit materials on his behalf. He was given an opportunity to have a hearing. In fact, they even held the hearing even when he said he wasn't going to come. They still went and had the hearing in case he wanted to show up. So he did not avail himself of all of the due process he was given. But this record is clear that he was given ample process in order to put his position forward as to why there were no material misrepresentations. And so that takes us to the Administrative Procedure Act and whether or not the final decision by Vice Admiral Hook suspending him was based on substantial evidence and not in violation of law. And Mr. Partington really raises no argument with respect to the APA that his rights were violated under that. And a review of Vice Admiral Hook's decision indicates that it was very soundly based. He did not simply rubber stamp the initial inquiry or the ethics investigation. He said that he reviewed the entire administrative record, including the trial court record and the materials submitted by Mr. Partington. And he still found that there were material misrepresentations that had been made in the appellate brief, and therefore the decision was to suspend Mr. Partington from the practice before the Navy JAG proceedings. This decision was soundly based in the Administrative Procedure Act. Therefore, for these reasons, we believe that this court should affirm the district court decision and uphold the Navy's decision in this regard. Are there any questions?
Seeing none, thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Hear from, how much, you had 3 minutes in rebuttal? Okay.
Your Honor, I would first point out that the Navy Marine Court criticized me for my trial conduct, but the eventual charges against me related to my conduct on appeal. There is presently a motion pending before this court asking that the court direct the government to answer certain sections of the complaint relating to these statements.
Counsel, when did we ever enter an order on a trial pleading?
Never.
Has that order not issued on that motion yet?
Never.
No, I'm seeing not. We denied that motion, didn't we?
No. Well, if you did, I haven't received a copy.
I don't know. Maybe because you had an attorney and it went to your attorney. We've denied that. There's no such motion pending now. We've never in the history of this court allowed such a motion, and we didn't allow that one. We never got a motion like that before, to the best of my knowledge.
Well, the reason that motion was made is because the government is not telling the truth, and I think this is very important. The government talks about all the evidence. What evidence? The government changed the verb tense of one of the statements and found me guilty of saying something that I did not say. What I said was in a timeline paragraph and referred to a particular point of time in the case. The Navy found me guilty of saying that I never made a particular motion. I never said I never made it. And the second point has to do with my statement that the military judge entered findings of not guilty. That is indisputably true. Yet the government comes here and keeps insisting that I misrepresented when I did not make any material misrepresentation in that brief. And that is very disturbing. And I hope that the court would be disturbed about that. One of the problems we have in this case is the government flatly refused to tell me how the statements were false. It also refused to tell me who had the burden of proof, who had the burden of producing evidence, what was the standard of proof, what presumptions applied in the proceeding. I mean, this is the epitome of the lack of due process. If you're going to allege that someone made false statements, the person has the right to know what the government alleges the truth is. Footnote 4 in Ruffalo is my case. The government wanted me to come and testify without telling me how my statements were false. And footnote 4 in Ruffalo is the exact reason I refused to go in the proceeding. They wanted to hear from me so they could pick out something they could find me guilty of. I most certainly was not going to participate in any such hearing. Any such hearing like that isn't fair. It doesn't give you any warning. You get ambushed, and that's what happened in Ruffalo's case. He was ambushed by the Ohio Bar, and the government wanted to ambush me here. I challenge the government to tell this court how my statements were false, because I don't know how they were false. The government has never told me how they were false. It's easy if you change the tense of a verb to change the meaning and then find the attorney guilty of something he never said.
You're actually over your time.
I'm very sorry, Your Honor. So, I apologize.
Counsel, and the case is submitted.